welcome to My First Dungeon, the tabletop role-playing podcast that helps game masters learn new games and make each one better than the last. This season, I stepped into the mantle of death, and what a mantle it was as we played
Nine Lives to Valhalla!
Yes, it feels good to say it. And back with me today to talk through this season of Ferocious Felines is one of our cast members from this season, Abby Hepworth. Abby, welcome back.
Hello. I'm glad to be back. Be Inga once again.
It's great to have Inga back. Spoilers from the gates of Valhalla, since yes. You did indeed fall.
I did.
You made all your deaths. But you weren't able to join us for some of our Patreon talkbacks, so we got you on this to talk with me and to talk with the designers, who I believe I should be introducing right now. Returning to help us close out the season are the designers of Nine Lives to Valhalla, Collie Lowry and Dan Phipps. Collie and Dan, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. First off, let me say, we had a ton of fun playing Nine Lives to Valhalla.
Awesome.
So thank you so much for making the game.
It was honestly such a blast. And the balance between the like high drama of Vikings and every role being so big and cats, it was like everything I ever wanted. It was perfect.
Well, that's great.
The high drama and cats.
And cats.
Yeah.
They're
dramatic by disposition, you know?
Exactly.
It kind of fell into place there.
And I guess first question, Dan and Collie, to you, what'd you guys think of the show?
The show was a lot of fun. I think I was listening to the first episode and was kind of waiting to see like, okay, how's this going to go? How are they going to work with this? And then at the point when a swordfish dived down a cat's throat, I was like, yes, okay, I am here. They've got this. Let's do this. This is great.
We're going hard. Yeah, this is happening.
That did really feel like the point where it kind of clicked and I was like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
I know what this is.
That is the game from Death's perspective in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, y'all rolled a lot of ties, it felt like.
Rolled a lot of ties.
That was wild.
Like we changed the design. It used to be you added the numbers and we changed it to just report the highest because we wanted ties to come up more often. Because mm-hmm. when you're rolling to, you know, like when you're adding together, it wasn't happening. But I feel like y'all even like we're on the extreme end of, man, just a lot of mutual
so
murder happening.
A lot of mutual, a lot of two people both stabbing each other at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the final episode, I had just a run of good luck of just death, just killing everybody for a second, which felt good and bad as I just keep looking at my players being like, I got a 10. There's no way you can beat me. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I rolled 2 12s.
I was going to say, you just kept beating us
You're dead.
One or two. And it was like, it's so great when it is so close. And I feel like that's interesting that you guys changed it from adding all the numbers up because yes, ties come up so much more often, but also when it's like 1 point off or 2 points off, it's so, even when you lose, it's so much more satisfying than you being like, well, I can't possibly add these numbers up to be 30, so you know what's happening here.
It feels more like, well, I almost did it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like I tried my best, and it's like, well, you rolled dice, but
yeah,
it was actually randomly generated, but very close,
but still I put my all into it.
Mm-hmm.
I have really liked doing more systems that are kind of like of that, like kind of Blades in the Darky type thing where it is take a dice pool and look at the top number, because it is, there's an immediacy to it that you like immediately know whether or not you succeeded. Because in a lot of games, you got to like do that quick moment of like, okay, what is 12 plus 9 again? Okay, you add the 10 and you subtract. Okay, oh, it's 21. Okay, did I beat it?
Yeah.
Which is also so important in this game because the energy has to be so high, and to keep that going, we didn't want people to get slowed down going, wait, okay, what's this dice plus this dice plus, let me do some mental math. It's like,
yeah.
Nope, just go, keep going, keep that energy rolling.
Yeah, there's definitely games that like that silence while people have to do basic arithmetic, which always takes longer when you're at a table rolling dice than in any other context.
Counting on your fingers at the table.
Like that, there are games where that tension is just exquisite. And in this one, it definitely felt like, okay, but momentum though, but faster, faster, faster.
But did I stab him?
Yeah, exactly.
A question I want to ask to you both is, so we've played a bunch of games on the show. And most notably for this next question, we played Wanderhome maybe a year and a half ago. And we had Jay Dragon on, wonderful game designer from Possum Creek. And we asked them, what'd you think of the game? Like, how did we do? Did we play the game right? And Jay very kindly took a long pause and then said, well, you didn't use any of the mechanics. And To be clear, that was my softball opening question, where the designer was supposed to say, you've had fun and you did it right and great job.
You did great.
And all of a sudden I had to pause and be like, oh my God, we never used the mechanics of this game. What did you guys think of our game as far as like, what did we do, whether, you know, quote unquote, right or wrong, that was maybe not as you intended as the designers?
So I really enjoyed how quickly, or it felt quick, the play got into the conceptual idea of what can be killed.
Yeah.
It was in the second episode of play, but like, can I kill the lights? And it's sort of like, well,
yeah.
Okay. I mean,
and we do
yeah,
say that, we,
you know, and like, it's one of those things where I think, you know, that's not even a intended or not intended, like I think that's delightful. But I was in my experience of play, the like that doesn't come up so often. Like usually that only comes up when I'm GMing it and I forget and I roll for something where it isn't immediately obvious what dies, and then a player reminds me, or I'm sitting there like, wait a minute, that wasn't okay, so you killed the concept of love, and we're going to just reap the world, or whatever, you know. And it felt like, and Abby, you can probably speak to this a bit better than I can, but it felt like the players immediately latched on to, like, the breadth of what it is to kill and be killed by something.
Well, and I think opening with, we're killing the storm,
kind
of open that door to, well, what else? If you can kill a storm, what else can you kill?
Right. Yeah. And I've definitely, like, in the pre-written adventure and so on, it's a lot, the baseline is a lot more literal, which, you know, is, again, like a change in approach, or like how to frame that, but not one I'm putting judgment on, because I just didn't think to like put in black and white, like, okay, here's a, you're going to kill the riddle or whatever.
Right. You're going to kill the mood.
Yeah, exactly. Which, so that was like the first thing I noticed, like, oh, that just felt different than the way that like I've played it in the past and I've seen it played.
I do think that our group, as soon as we sort of realized that you could expand it beyond like, oh, I'm battling my nemesis and one of us will die, that it was these concepts or kill the tension, kill the lights, like these other things. I think our group, as soon as we kind of realized that you could expand it beyond that, got really excited about the concept of like, oh, I could do anything, and kind of ran with it. And it was incredibly fun. Yeah.
Well, I think it was around that time where you guys started realizing that I got really tickled by you guys figuring out other idioms that have the word kill in it. So the second, like, there's a couple times in, I think, episodes like 2 and 3, where you guys were like, can I want to do this. And I was like, I'm not going to give you any extra dice, or I'm not going to, no. And then someone's like, well, can I kill time? And I'm like, absolutely, you can kill time. Take an extra dice.
Rules as written. Nothing says
you can kill death. So
yeah.
Right? Yeah. I think, it was as soon as we realized, oh, it's endless possibilities of it's just in how you phrase it, or the nuance, or I think we did that with a lot of things as well. Of once that mechanic kind of got opened up, was also then we were like, well, what else can we interpret in interesting ways of like some of the blessings and other things mm-hmm. where we were like, ooh, but like, what if you took a slightly different meaning of that?
Oh, because Abby, you had one that I had narrated, like this final fight is like tons of light. Like the lights yeah. are going crazy. So it's like the brightest thing in the room. And you were like, I want to attack from the darkness. I want to use like the blessing of Bubastis's fur or something to attack from the darkness, get an extra D6. And I was like, there's no. I described this as being the most lit area in the world right now.
We're in all a very well lit target. Like,
and then you and everyone else was like, no, she's attacking from the darkness of her heart. And I was like, all right.
I was like, yeah, there's the darkness to her. It doesn't say it has to be literal. It's dim light in here.
You bring your own darkness.
Exactly.
I bring the darkness. I am the darkness.
Well, and it's also like, you know, filing under feature not a bug territory. Mm. Like, yeah. Okay, you're killing time. The inverse is that means that time can kill you. And that puts a really fun kind of reverse interpretive puzzle on Death's shoulders of like, all right, I guess you try to wait it out and then you turn to dust of old age, like, or whatever. Because like, man, sometimes the dice goes bad, right? Or what have you.
One of the things I was worried about going into this game was making each dice roll, because like every roll something could die. It could be like your character, so you got to make sure that every roll is epic and meaningful, and you don't want to, you're not doing perception checks, or if you are, something's got to kill you. And so I was worried about that. And going in, I was like, okay, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling everything's going well. And then I think in episode 2, I kind of on a lark tell Carolyn Page's character, Mr. Tumbo, to roll against a tub of cheese balls. like the idea being like she might get overwhelmed by the cheese flavor. And I'm like, they're rolling 2d4s. You're rolling like, I want to say Mr. Tumbo's rolling like 2d10s and a d6 or something. I was like, okay, this is a cute joke that you're doing, Brian. Great. Just roll 2d4s. I rolled a 4 and a 3. And Carolyn, I think, rolled like 1, 1, 2. Mm-hmm. And now I'm stuck in a place of like, okay, you got to die gloriously to some cheese balls now. I'm sorry.
And now it's everyone's problem because, yeah. You know, exactly, like, yeah. you have to accept the death or else you can another one.
Right.
there's a great bit of like true improv training in that of like someone else does something that fully doesn't work and you have to go with it. I'm like, all right, sorry, everybody. We're going to figure this out together. Mm-hmm.
There's a one act play, and it's going to drive me nuts that I can't remember what it is, but there's a one act play and it's like conceptual and it's two people having this dialogue and they're on a first date. And then there's a bell in the middle, like a bellhop bell. And then every time somebody says something awkward on the first date, the other person on the date like hits the bell and then they give a different answer. And then the conversation continues.
Oh, that's fun.
That's funny.
And it's something I think about a lot in terms of like safety tools. Like this is obviously not a safety tool. This is a, everyone have a good time baked into the setting tool,
right,
with that has safety overlap. But I got to dig that up. I'm trying to remember how I even heard of it. But it's very much that sort of like, okay, but we need to keep this thing going. And like, if anybody gets, you know, in the same way that, yes, you can use the X card for obviously making sure everyone's comfortable. You can also use the X card to be like, I think you can do better than that. I'm going to X card your answer. And
I
like,
want more glory.
Yeah. Think on that a little bit harder and then answer. Or like, I'm not going to answer that X card or whatever.
There is a pretty common improv game that is people on stage doing a scene and then someone will hit a bell and it's like new choice. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, hey, I want to take you to the prom, ding. I want to take you to the movies, ding. I want to take you to the morgue. And then like, so you just have to spit things out until something comes out that people are going to try to play with. And it's a great exercise for having to, you can't plan because mm-hmm. your plan immediately gets tripped out from under you. You do plans B, C, D, E, and F before someone says, yeah, try to get out of that box. And I think it's a fun challenge for improvisers and for performers to like kind of play with each other that way in like a fun way of you've been planning this in your head for the last minute. Let's take that away from you and let's see what you have to do off the top of your head.
Let's see. Are you a brilliant ice skater or are you going to skitter like a little chihuahua on ice?
Exactly.
I feel like that's a really fun, yes, like twist on the X card safety tool idea. And I feel like, especially for a game like this, where again, like each role, the intention is to be really glorious and epic. And there were definitely times where I would roll and Inga would die. And I was like, oh man, the pressure's on. Like, how do I make this as big and epic and glorious as possible? And I feel like taking the time to make that decision is really good. But it's also the kind of thing of if I do it, something and someone's like, oh, she could be better than that. Like, I like that playfulness and the sort of one-upping each other, especially here. Yeah.
That's fun. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where like, we don't want it to be, oh, and things are really hard for the GM, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
I think it's in the text to be like, yeah, just ask. If you can't think of a good depth, mm-hmm. just ask the table. And
I think there's also, as written, the description is supposed to be, at least to some extent, made by the cat, which does take some pressure off of the GM. Or that's not true, and I'm just misremembering our own game. So,
No, I feel like all of us also really relished the idea because our characters were so fun and so fun to build, and we all really were like getting very into it. We had a lot of cat people also within the cast, so that helped. But
it was very fun to have notably one non-cat person being Michelle Chan Bennett, who played Hello Kitty, who anytime we got like cutesy about our cats, she was just like noticeably being like, I don't know about you people.
Like, tighten up, guys. But yeah, to have our cats really take the lead on there so that Brian could, so that it was a balance of the story building and it wasn't entirely on Brian.
Yeah, I think that's something more and more we keep talking about, wanting our games to foster a sort of collaborative nature at mm-hmm. the table, to get more people involved, to let the GM be a player themselves. Because it's, I don't know, I spent a lot of time in theaters and coming from that area. And the thing that I miss about it is always that collaborative sense of working together to build something that is fun and incredible. And whenever we can bring that to the table, this opportunity to work together to make something awesome, mm-hmm. I kind of want to, because in my opinion, it's a lot more fun to get to be involved in the story making.
And not only is it more fun, I think players get so much more invested if they get to build their corner of the world. I used to have this, I ran this other podcast called Cannon Fodder that was kind of like a world building game show. And we'd like spin the wheel of world building and you'd see what we're doing. So it would be like, you know, food, culture, idioms, handshakes. And we'd like build a part of a world. And I had a bunch of comedians on. And every single time I'd be like, okay, food, what does food look like? And the comedian would be like, they eat poop. Because they're a comedian.
They go for like the lowest, you know, the easiest joke they could make.
Lowest hanging fruit.
Ding.
Yeah. Yes.
But by the end, because then I'd immediately go, okay, well, let's dig into that. And I'm going to make you honor whatever choice you made. We're going to go in. And by the end, whatever dumb bit they did, they were now so invested. They're like, no. Okay. So like they eat poop, but it's like they have to refine it into new food. And they have this whole waste management system, and their whole culture is built around waste management. Okay. And these are actually the most environmentally friendly people. And so anyone who, you know, and people would just go in and in and in. And by the end, they were like, oh, I love this part of the world that I did one dumb joke about. But if you give people that opportunity and then kind of treat their decisions seriously and kind of drill down on them, they really fall into the hole of loving the world that they've built and loving the world that you've built together.
The author of Ultraviolet Grasslands, whose name escapes me at this exact moment, has a really good blog post called Anti-Canon Worlds. Ooh. Where he talks about his approach to, he has this whole thing about how you can, about having that balance where, you know, Ultraviolet Grasslands is this really psychedelic, really cool, Luka Rejic. I should have just committed to that. because I was like 98%. Doesn't matter.
We got there.
But treating everything in your world building and setting and so on as kind of the way you have to treat real world history, where it's like, well, somebody wrote this down. Like, this was somebody's opinion of what happened. And these are all rumors. But like, until you go see it, you know, you can't really hold too tightly to any of this. Oh,
interesting.
This is a wildly reductive version of it. But it really stuck with me as this sort of approach to describing and both writing settings and writing systems of like making sure that there's that negative space, making sure that you're not writing anything too authoritatively or too ironclad where it is going to intrude on play, where it is going to stop people from getting to build their own thing.
Yeah, we like to leave room for people to get invested in their own ways.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so anyways, it's good reading. Go read that blog post.
We'll put it in the show notes. I have found that the more I talk to game masters, people who run more and more games, I didn't believe this when I first like started listening to interviews with game masters where someone would ask them like, what's the biggest difference from when you started to now? And without a doubt, they all say, I prepare way less or I prepare nothing. And like when I was first running games, I was like, you know, spending hours writing down stuff. And there's still a joy in that, you know, that mm-hmm. prepping a session is, you know, solo play kind of. But the more I play, the better results I've found with having less and less, and like, you know, knowing kind of what you're doing, but letting the players fill in the gaps and creating that more vibrant world because quite frankly, there is no one in the world that wouldn't be better with having five co-collaborators. Like, there's no one so genius that their vision needs to be singular.
Well, yeah. And I love when you are lucky enough to have a table where everyone is invested in that collaboration. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you might end up with a group where it's like, okay, there's two people who are really invested and some people who are along for the ride. And it's like, well, that's cool to be along for the ride. Also, you can get such a better thing if everyone is invested and wanting to be a developmental part of the thing you're building together.
Yeah. Definitely. It was very funny in our session zero towards the end, or Brian was asking like, you know, stars and wishes, or like, what are the things that you want of, you know, do you want it to be, you know, constant bloody gory battles? Do you like puzzles? Do you like this? And every single person who went around the table would say something new, and all the rest of us would be like, oh yes, we want that. Like, it was, everyone was so excited, and the enjoyment kept building up on top of every new thing that a person said. And then I thought that why Brian interpreted a lot of the things of like, I love riddles and puzzles and things. So having these, you know, a Target and a Barnes and Noble and the Starbucks and all these other things that it didn't click. I did not solve it. It took somebody else
The Noble Repository of Tomes and Lost Knowledge?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Brian's describing this whole scene. And I was like, I have no idea what is happening right now. I love it, but I don't understand. And then somebody was like, oh my God, it's magazines. And I was like, oh, there we go.
Oh yeah. Oh yes, of course.
But yeah, it was.
Yeah, what was it? Sour stretchy pants or what? Yeah.
Sour fruit stretchy pants.
Stretchy pants.
There we go.
Which I feel like you must have had so much fun, Brian, coming up with
all
those things.
I loved it.
Great.
I forget what Victoria's Secrets was. The secret repository of two holy garments or something like that.
Something, yeah.
Those were very fun. It was also great to watch. I was basically just watching Michelle's face anytime I said those, because she'd just go, God damn it, it's Barnes and God. Just like every time throwing up her hands.
But yeah, we had a lot of fun as a table, I think. As you said, collaborating, building. Everybody was so invested in it. We all took like cats in a different, like for a different turn, you know, a different inspiration and things. So it's a very collaborative table.
The 80s are over. And you're not kids anymore. Now is a much darker time. Something happened to you and you got touched by the weird, and it made you wild and it made you powerful. This is the world of The Lost Bay, a suburban gothic RPG. A fever dream set in 1990X and inspired in equal parts by dark fantasy, horror classics, and the 90s indie culture. After years of development, and thanks to the feedback and support of a community of early enthusiasts, The Lost Bay is coming to Kickstarter, featuring a full rulebook and complete setting designed by Eco, kick-ass art by Evangeline Gallagher, killer maps by Strega Wolf Vandenberg, and 6 additional modules by some of the coolest designers in the indie scene. So go right now to thelostbayrpg.com to back this project. That's thelostbayrpg.com. The Gardens of Yin is now funding on Kickstarter. The Gardens of Yin is a randomized depth crawl adventure set in an ever-shifting, extra-dimensional garden. The deeper you head into the gardens, the more perilous and unusual the locations become, ending in whatever secrets lie in the garden's deepest depths. Each route of your expedition is generated as it's explored, resulting in new vistas being unlocked with every visit. This campaign will remaster Gardens of Yin by Emmy Allen, with new art by Riot Bones and an offset print run by Soul Muppet Publishing. Gardens of Yin is made for old-school systems, but can be easily converted for use in other TTRPGs. To support this project, search Gardens of Yin on Kickstarter. That's Gardens of Yin, spelled Y-N-N, on Kickstarter. Have you ever had a boring boss battle in a role-playing game? Ever struggled your way to the climax of a dungeon only to spend 3 hours taking turns rolling to hit? Ever wished there was a way to have exciting fights where your tactics matter without getting bogged down in minutiae and maths? Of course you have. And the good folks at Rowan Rook & Deckard, creators of Spire, Heart, and many other fine role-playing games, are doing boss battles justice with Hollows. Hollows uses a lock-on combat grid focused around the boss monster instead of the location, so it's always the center of attention, and your position always matters. With rules inspired by Bloodborne and Monster Hunter, and a setting inspired by Silent Hill and Jacob's Ladder, Hollows is a unique new game from award-winning designers Grant Howitt and Christopher Taylor. You can learn more and download the free quick start adventure, The Sins of Grisham Priory, by visiting rrdgames.com/hollows. I will say, just shouting out some of the stuff that I think this season was probably the most inspired by a module of a season we've done. Maybe this and Orbital Blues, pulling a lot of great stuff from The Wreck of the Murderous. Just to give props where props are due, the final fight, the Abomination Man, Cult of the Leash. Second I read Cult of the Leash, I was like, oh my god. The dogs with collars on, with their leashes in their mouth, offering it up to a reviving man. Yes, please.
Incredible.
And then I believe this was your, I don't think this was mine, the Hummingbird Assassins.
I think that was like an example of like something that would be tricky, I think, was.
Yes.
Just sort of throwing in this like, yeah, there's dragons and coyotes, whatever. They're the same thing functionally to a domesticated cat.
Right. I will say the Hummingbird Assassins ended up being, I think, the most effective monster out of like anything I threw at you guys, because it was that moment of there's nothing around, roll. And I saw everyone's faces go, what do you mean roll? It's quiet and there's nothing. And then having that, you know, assassin bullet type thing, I think was the time in this game I saw everyone get most on edge and like into it,
mm-hmm.
because you were trying to figure out like, what the hell is this thing?
Yeah, they were very cool. And I really love, as you're saying, dragging Coyote to a domestic cat. What is the difference between the two? And having a game where there's a lot of high fantasy and craziness and whatever, but a lot of it just ties back to, like, you don't need to go full mythological creature to have this.
Just change your perspective.
Hit, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Abby, I did want to ask you, because we didn't get to ask any questions about Inga during our Patreon talkbacks. Inga, the only cat to have their final death and pass through the gates of Valhalla. How did it feel? Because I know you were on your last life after the end of episode one and held on for a miraculously long time. I'm curious for you, because in this game, anytime you roll, there's a chance you die. Like, there's no way to, like, take cover and fire pot shots at an enemy like mm-hmm. you could in, like, D&D or Pathfinder or something. It's just not mechanically there. How did it feel getting down to one life relatively early in the game?
Well, it was funny because I feel like I'm a player who, especially when I'm playing a new game, really likes to, I get, like, roll happy if I'm like, let me do 1,000 rolls just so I can get a sense of the game and the mechanic and all these sorts of things, whatever. And I think I did that a handful of times and I think died like 3 times in a row, rapid fire. And yep. I was like, oh, you can't do that in this game. you're going to die. And so learning and adjusting with that was really fun. But I think it was really an interesting way to make me feel more invested and more intentional. And like you were referencing, the momentum kind of keep going and we've got to keep the pace and things of it intensified all of the parts of the game, even though I wasn't necessarily using the mechanics that often, which was such an interesting switch from where my brain goes just sort of usually or my usual, like, go-to for how to learn a new game. And then, yes, very quickly, I was like, oh, Inga, oh no. But it was interesting because then with the final, yes, I mean, in the big final battle, I feel like it was a lot of trying to help and plan and work with the group and then waiting for my moment, knowing I wanted to make it really epic and knowing, I want to say there were 2 successes with my final life before I failed on it. But just the, like, my heart pounding with it and wanting to make sure that whatever I'm doing, I'm okay with that being that last turn, which, yes, she goes out hard.
It is a terrifying thing to, at any time, your game master could basically say, roll a death saving throw. And you're like, oh no!
Yeah.
For anything.
For absolutely anything.
For everything, yes. It was a little bit of a, oh, wait. And then I think I forget how many lives I started with, but I thought that was really fun as well of rolling at the beginning to see for our session zero how many lives you started with. Helped as well build Inga as a character of, like, she's been around the block. She knows what to expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did really like how it felt like you had a good spread of some cats who were already over halfway through mm-hmm. and yeah. really experienced and these, like, fresh out of the nest, like, brand new cats with just one or even no deaths was like, oh good, we've got a good like a mentor experience yeah. almost.
I did really love that, and when we play again, I feel like we'll want very much to do that. Of I love the mix of them instead of everybody. I mean, there's a joy to everybody being brand new, or even if you're like, we're gonna do a real quick power play where everyone has one life left, like. But I do love, yeah, that mix. It just helps create a dynamic between the characters sort of inherently.
Yeah, I think there's one thing that I don't know of anybody actually playing through to these rules, but there are the options we built in for if you make it to your last death and you don't want to
be done.
All of these different things you can do, whether like refusing Valhalla and dragging your corpse along or becoming a companion crow to death or there's a handful of them
or just
in
new
there.
Cat, whatever.
And I think by and large people have gone, okay, new cat.
Yeah.
Right.
But one of those things is it's interesting also because it really highlights the one of the distinctions between normal table play and putting on an actual play, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, obviously you as a player want a big final death, but also kind of whatever, like they're all gonna be big. So, you know, the like you said, there's all these sort of suggestions for how to keep things going if you don't want to be done for the night. That also, when you are putting on a sort of radio drama, mm-hmm. that's all very well and good, but you have to care a lot more about the arc of the thing than we necessarily wrote the game to support. So I feel like I'm really glad that you were able to sort of find that balance in situ, since that's something the game wasn't really designed to concern itself with, was mm-hmm. like, oh, make sure, oh, someone's down to one life, like we're going to make sure death gets a big boss fight line of like, no, whatever, everything's a big boss fight, who cares?
Right.
Well, people who are doing this for the entertainment of other people are the people who care, but you know.
But it is a very specific scenario. But yeah. I feel like even when I was realizing, okay, I'm down to one and this, that especially knowing that we were playing a more limited stretch, so it wasn't just going to, you know, continue on for however long we wanted it to go, like a home game might. Knowing as well that if Inga goes up to Valhalla, that I could just continue to be part of the table of, you know, joking around of like, Inga's looking down on you guys and being like, what the hell was that move? Or you suddenly see like the clouds part and it's Inga, you know, providing sunlight in a situation, or, you know,
Inga granting a blessing or something.
Yeah, there were ways for me to keep doing the sort of role-playing aspect of things, even though technically, mechanically, she was gone, which was a fun thing as well, knowing where it's like, okay, yes, she's dying, but she's going to Valhalla and she'll still hang out. She'll say hey when everybody else comes up for a minute and then they go back down.
I am curious about a thing that I had trouble with while I was playing. It came up a couple times in that everyone had their nemeses. And because everyone had nemeses and they care about killing them so much, they all approached them like very cautiously. They made sure that they were ready to go and kill them. And then without fail, they killed them before they got any kind of monologue or anything. So all of a sudden, like, you know, Mr. Tumbo's nemesis, who we never learned the backstory of, just gets killed. And then we kind of have the joke of like, what he did was so horrible, we can't even talk about it. I'm curious, have you guys ever experienced that in games that you run, that like the nemeses, because they are like highlighted villains, end up being somehow less epic because everyone's like treating them in a different way? Does it make sense? I think I just whiffed it each time is honestly what it is.
Versus the henchmen and stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the nemesis thing sort of, we had two problems. We had that character creation felt a little thin, and we had, well, what happens if everyone dies? Because of, you know, and so it was like, well, and we kind of tried to solve both of those with the same
nemesis.
with a nemesis. Well, if they, you know, whoever killed you all must retroactively be a big deal. And now that we've got nemesis.
I like nemesis. Let's go with that.
Yeah, like, all right, well, let's fold that into character creation. I have not historically had players who approached even the neighborhood of thinking tactically in playing this game. So that was not...
I think there's been a lot more like, oh, there's a cliff, I'll run off of it.
Yeah, like trying to explain that you have to at least give me a role. You can't just like, I don't know, farm XP
right
through you
Quick
know
death.
Through disobeying OSHA. So but yeah, the idea that we have this whole thing where it's like, oh, are they armored or are they like magic or whatever, and like I think listening to y'all play was the first time anyone was like, oh, I should change like what weapon I use.
I did notice
that.
Like the way that the way you guys went through character creation in this very thoughtful acknowledgement of what parts would affect other parts and kind of rearranged things so that you would have an opportunity to be really thoughtful about it, as opposed to just being like, yeah, I'm going for it. Woo!
I do think
there's a slightly different culture of play there.
Yes, I think some of it may, again, be a little related to knowing that we are wanting to perform and be intentional, but also that, yes, there's a very funny balance between the people who we play with. I feel like there's always the people who read through every option, think about optimizing, what are we going to do here? How would this affect that? And then there are people who are like, that sounds fucking cool. Add it to the list. I don't care that it doesn't jibe with everything else. It just is chaotic awesome.
For us, it's really the difference between people who approach March Madness by watching all the games before March Madness and the people who approach March Madness by who has the coolest mascot.
Yes.
Oh. So our family has a big extended March Madness thing, and I don't follow the games. So some years I've flipped a coin. One year in particular, I did a mascot battle of, okay, which mascot do I think is going to win here? It ended up with one of the Devils winning, and I was completely wrong, last place.
But you had to figure out if a Sun Devil or a Blue Devil was more powerful, which was a sort of extended.
And then, neither one of them ended up in it. No, I'm like, well, that's just wrong.
You're like, well, if this were truly a battle of the mascots, it clearly would have come down to the Devil versus Devil situation.
Devils, right?
Yeah.
Oregon basketball tends to do better than a duck would do against a bear. For
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always pick the bracket based on if I know anyone who went to that school. For this year, I have predicted that the men's final will be St. Peter's versus Colgate. So fingers crossed.
Wow. You don't know anyone who went to any realistic basketball school?
You know what?
Anybody?
I'm going for full, unhinged, unpredictable chaos there.
Well, all right. If anyone wants to win some money, just play against Abby. as we kind of wind down this interview, I do. There are some questions from our Discord I wanted to ask you guys. But this is from user Sharknado. Sharknado, thank you for asking a question. And the question is, if you were to follow up Nine Lives, what would it be? If you were to make like a follow up game to Nine Lives.
You know, we did when we were playtesting, we had a surprising amount of feedback from people saying, okay, but I want to play as a dog.
Oh. And
we didn't end up pursuing that because it kind of breaks the mechanic in that, well, cats have nine lives, dogs don't. So if you're playing as a dog, then you just have one life. Mm. So that it felt unfair to be like, all right, these players have nine lives and this player has one. Wah, wah.
Right. Like you potentially get one roll and if you lose, you're out of the game.
Game's over for you. Go home.
We did write a Forged in the Dark game that was sort of published before Gemroom Games had spun up. Called, I think, Fangs, Plagues, and Gunpowder.
Which was we took this idea of the Age of Beasts and this feedback we were getting of people wanting to play different ones and started spinning up a rat one.
And,
okay, let's come up with a whole bunch of different animal groupings had to take away the nine lives thing and replace it with a sort of more straightforward Forged in the Dark system. But pairing up all these different animals and seeing, well, how do you change the language to make it suit a dog or a rat or a llama? I forget what animals we looked at.
Really ran the gamut, yeah.
I feel like there's a sequel game here in something of like, All Dogs Go to Heaven, of like a dog wakes up in hell and has to battle their way into heaven or something.
Oh, a reverse Doom.
Exactly.
It's reverse Doom.
It's just reverse Doom.
Actually,
I love that elevator pitch.
Wait, that's good. All right, write it down.
Yeah, no, that's actually very compelling.
Coming soon from Jim.
Yeah, no, that actually
All
did.
Dogs Go to Heaven.
All right, I'm writing that down.
You can have it. We just want a special thanks.
Yeah, you get
the
it.
First official actual play.
Nice.
Hell yeah.
So I was curious because I know you did like custom stuff. Mm-hmm. Like there was, I think, an invisibility potion that was caffeinated that I remember. Like, did you feel, how did that feel? How did it feel coming up with like magic items and that kind of stuff for Nine Lives?
It felt pretty easy. I think with the caffeine thing, I knew the hummingbird assassins. I was like, that's cool. And I was like, okay, how do I make them scarier? Like they're moving even faster. And I remember there was some anime or something where someone drinks a bunch of coffee and all of a sudden they're like almost blinking out of existence. And I was like, that's hilarious. And I like that. And the second I knew there was going to be a Starbucks, I was like, okay, what happens if a cat drinks Star? And the idea of something getting like so jittery, it's functionally invisible, was very fun. It's like, that's Sasquatch, you know, it's just so jittery. You can't get a picture of him.
I know Elliot also had a lot of fun with the concept of like catnip and different types of catnip being his like potions and doing other sorts of things. And I think that the world itself, with all the blessings and all of the information that's in the book, lends itself well to give you a lot of jumping off points to homebrew your own magical items.
It is also pretty easy, like mechanically, of if I want to give a mechanical advantage, great. I could bump up the size of a dice. I could add another dice. Like, it's pretty simple and it's pretty easy to like intuitively be like, okay, this is, you know, a minor magic item. You get to add a D4. Okay, this is a major magic item. All your dice go to 12. But for the next roll, all your dice go to 12. But the roll after that, they all go to 4 as you have like a caffeine crash or something. There's a lot of fun to play with there that feels very intuitive because you're just like, great. Make it bigger or make it more in a way that you don't really have to worry about balancing it because it's
or breaking
as long as something dies.
Right.
it is also so much different from something that's like add, you know, if you cast Pass Without a Trace in D&D, you add 10 to your stealth checks. It's like that. I could see how that breaks something. This, it's like, okay, great. You can add a D12. That D12 can still roll a goddamn one. Like, and it did in many cases in this game. So it feels very intuitive and accessible.
You're not worried you're going to break the whole game.
Yeah.
By going a little off book.
That was what I was hoping it would feel like. So I'm glad to hear that. Because it wouldn't break the game, but the presentation and the reality are different, you know? So I was really glad to hear that was like coming into it and was hoping that it didn't feel scary to do. So that's thrilled. Yeah,
it felt great. And I think it was one of those things. I don't think for any of the items I had a prescribed plan for what they would mechanically do until the minute I said it. So I think I came in, I was like, I know what this will functionally, you will functionally be invisible. What does that mean for you? And that's what you kind of feel it in the moment. And I think after playing that first episode, especially after that first ship battle, I had a pretty good sense of like what the dice did.
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew what, you know, a check felt like. And once you have that feeling down, you can improvise within it in a way that felt pretty easy. Dan Colley, thank you so much for being a part of this season, for creating Nine Lives of Valhalla. Can you tell the people where they can find you and your games online?
So you can find pretty much all our stuff and or links to our stuff at gemroomgames.com.
And if you use the code MyFirstDungeon, check out to get 10% off of Nine Lives to Valhalla and or the adventure module Wreck of the Murderous. I highly recommend getting both because they are both very good. And that is all for this episode and indeed this season of My First Dungeon. Thank you so much for joining us. If you want even more My First Dungeon, you can head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod to get bonus actual plays, cast talkbacks for this season, and a whole lot more. I think at this point we have somewhere over 35 hours of bonus content.
Damn.
As well as a number of free games designed by us, designed by Elliot, as well as some music, original music from Behold. So go check it out. It's a great place to hang. And as always, remember, If you're having fun, you're already doing it right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Now. Now.
If you're hearing this, that means you listen to every last second of this episode. And if you simply cannot wait until the next episode drops, you should head over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and become a member of the Dice Pool. Fresh! For just a few bucks a month, you'll get cast talkbacks, original games, and a full-length bonus actual play each and every month. As of the end of 2023, there's already over 20 hours of bonus audio, plus a whole bunch of other goodies to enjoy. So head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and jump on into the dice pool. We'll see you there. Splash!